unknown. The most famous objet d'art in the Kim Il-sung Gift Museum is a stuffed crocodile stood on its legs bearing a tray in its claws holding six goblets, for all the world like a waiter. It was the gift from the people of Nicaragua. "I began to get the giggles," wrote Hitchens, imagining that Kim Il-sung had thousands and thousands of dotty aunts and batty uncles, and had solemnly resolved to keep every one of their rubbishy birthday and Christmas presents in case they ever came to call. At our museum, the soldiers trooped in behind us, some grinning, some staring, but not impolitely. They, of course, are the target audience for all this. That foreigners so admire the Kim dynasty, they wish to celebrate or at least appease its majesty, like the tributes in the Hunger Games. Of the truth that this is probably the most mocked regime on the planet, they have no idea. In the halls housing tributes to Kim Jong-il, we came across a painting of Bad Elvis astride a white Siberian tiger. This was probably the worst example of tyrant kitsch I have seen with my own eyes in my entire life, and I'm something of an expert. Kim, too, appeared to be wearing Elvis's white rhinestone cowboy suit with matching shades. To big up midget turd, the artist had drawn the tiger's back curiously short. Rather than riding a majestic big cat, it looked as though Kim was on the back of a pale tabby cat. The effect was irresistibly comic. Jice, the student from Morocco, pointed to Elvis on tabby and asked deadpan, "Would the dear leader not be offended by such a gift?" Stony-faced, Mr. Hyun asked Jice exactly what he meant. The local guide seemed apoplectic. I moved away, trying to suppress hysterical giggles. It was like getting the funnies inside a courtroom. The worse it is, the funnier it gets. Tomiko explained that Jice was from Morocco and that in his country, all cats, including tigers, were considered vermin. Mr. Hyun looked unconvinced. In semi-disgrace, we were asked to leave. Chapter 12. The Man Who Went to North Korea and Came Back Mad. In 1971, the Romanian dictator, Nicolae Ceausescu, went to North Korea. He liked Pyongyang so much he returned in 1978, and the film of this trip is on YouTube. It's an unforgettable 5 minutes of two tyrants just having fun. The video opens with Ceausescu in a black suit and tie and Kim Il-sung in a light grey Mao suit. The two big men are standing up in an open-top limousine, driving through the streets of the big zombie, in an immense motorcade led by 20 police motorcycle outriders. Thousands line the streets crying, "Hosanna!" or some such in Korean, but the actual soundtrack of the video is supplied by a living dead choir, roaring out a weird sound wave, ebbing and flowing rhythmically. A pod of ladies in white Korean traditional dresses, holding pink doodahs in each hand, whir, rotate, and clap in perfect synchronicity, as if each one is a music box mannequin. Balloons are released. A footbridge painted with rainbow colours arcs across the motorway. On it, more ladies in white doing their stuff. The limousine passes two portraits, one of the Romanian, the other of the North Korean. Ceausescu is center frame, passing the camera, waving manically. Kim Il-sung is more restrained. He's been to this kind of party before. He doesn't quite yawn, but he accepts the mass adulation like the Fonz might. The motorcade swings into Kim Il-sung Square, and then the fun begins. Maybe 100,000 people crowd the square, maybe more. Closest to the motorcade, more ladies dance, waving things that look like paper flower bouquets, creating the impression of so much multicolored seaweed floating this way and that in the tide. Half a dozen black-suited security men trot along beside the limousine as it passes a maypole, then yet more ladies, this time North Korean versions of Mary Poppins, wave their brollies aloft. The two great men enter a vast stadium, clapping, Mao-style, lightly on their hands, while the masses roar their adoration. Then they sit down at two vast wooden desks, as big as a lifeboat on a channel ferry, and feel the love. The masses oblige. Opposite the stage, a sign at least 100 feet high, created by a vast throng of people holding up flashcards, proclaims, Thryaska Tovarasul, Conducetor Jubit Sistimat Al Popuru Lui Romun, which means, Long live Comrade Nicolae Ceausescu, esteemed and beloved leader of the Romanian people. The show continues with the flash card crown building Kim Il-sung against the background of heavy industry, using a walkie-talkie pointing to a giant tractor and lorry. A real biplane puffs out show smoke at an extraordinarily slow speed. Fireworks make white puffy clouds against a perfect blue sky. The twosome shake hands aloft, Kim Il-sung jolly and delighted, Ceausescu a bit peevish. A few video frames back from the end, you can make out, sat between the two dictators, a small Romanian diplomat in a black suit, grinning at the fun. 35 years later, that man sits in front of me in his small flat, not far from the center of Bucharest, living history. Isidore Urian, small, wiry, sprite, instantly likable, his English extraordinarily precise for a man in his 80s, first went to North Korea by train in 1954. Back then, the journey from Bucharest to Pyongyang lasted 14 days. With Isidore now was his wife, Emilia, who clucked around her husband, a loving hen, occasionally putting her head to one side and smiling as a detail of something that happened 4 or 5 decades ago eluded him. Their flat was no palace, being on the 7th floor of a typically nondescript block in a not conspicuously fashionable area of the Romanian capital, but within, the walls were decorated with pictures of Korea and framed ideograms, the calligraphy dark strokes against the white of the artist's paper. Why North Korea? God decided. In the early 1950s, the communist lords of Romania were looking for bright working-class boys to become the new diplomatic corps, and Isidore, who fitted that bill, was picked for Pyongyang. He became so fluent in Korean that in the 1990s, while serving as ambassador of Romania to South Korea, he won the first prize in a translation competition for foreigners. But did he suffer for his art? To begin, I asked Isidore about that trip to Pyongyang in 1978. It was extremely difficult for me, he said ruefully. He had been working on the Asian desk for the Romanian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but at a few days' notice, he was ordered to fly out to Pyongyang. Ceausescu arrived. The visit started, but the leader hadn't brought an official note-taker. My job was to translate, but I also had to make notes at the same time. I scribbled notes, then at night I stayed up to 2 or 3 in the morning, transcribing my scribble into formal memos. After 3 or 4 days of this, I was so exhausted I could barely function. Once, during the visit, Ceausescu and Elena, his ghastly wife, a barely educated numbskull the Romanian propaganda machine had magicked into a doctor of chemistry, had left Pyongyang and we were going on a train to a mountain residence of Kim Il-sung for a short break from talks. We were in a special carriage. I told them that I was so exhausted I could neither see nor hear. It was Elena who was nastiest. Why can't you take notes? Write every word down. I replied that I had been translating all day and writing up the notes all night. I hadn't eaten in 2 days. Why not? asked Elena. I can't eat and translate at the same time. When you leave, I have to leave too, so I don't get to eat, I replied. Elena barked back. The Korean translator had no problem. That's because there are three of them, and they work in rotation. Elena put on her nastiest face and said, It's not your place to complain. Ceausescu, who everyone says was a kinder man than Elena when it came to handling servants, intervened, and Isidore finally got some rest. At the end of the North Korean trip, Isidore was booked on a flight back to Bucharest, but Ceausescu interrupted, saying that that was a waste of money, and told Isidore to come on the Romanian presidential jet with the rest of party to Hanoi. On leaving Hanoi, it turned out the runway was too short, the jet too heavy, so they dumped Isidore on the tarmac. He had $3 on him. 1 week later, he managed to hitch a flight to Pakistan in a cargo plane. On that flight, no food and drink, only cold. At Karachi, he spent the last of his money on 2 bottles of 7-Up, which was his only food and drink for the 17-hour flight back to Eastern Europe. The translator shook his head. That's why I shall never forget that visit. He recalled Pyongyang in 1954, immediately after the Korean War. It really was, as it says in the Bible, not one stone upon another. No buildings, no electricity, no running water, no heating. Our embassy was a small villa, a little away from the city. It had no glass windows, only scraps of cardboard. Later they built an apartment building for us. There was no heating. In winter it was extremely cold. Eventually they brought me a very large duvet, and I sewed up the bottom of it, making a sleeping bag. How did he find Kim Il-sung? Like a god. The great leader was charming to Isidore, very friendly, had a ready laugh. He wanted everyone to know that he was looking after the ordinary people. That was true, but there was some acting, too. The Romanian seemed to have the mindset of many North Koreans of the older generation, happy to give Kim the First the benefit of the doubt, but more critical of Kim's 2 and 3. Isidore recalled translating for Ceausescu in Korea, and there was no chair, so he was obliged to stand. Kim noticed and said, Why are you standing? Grab yourself a chair. On Kim Il-sung's last trip to Europe in 1985, Isidore accompanied him on the train journey from Bucharest, remember he hated flying, to the eastern border. As dawn came up, Kim sent word to Isidore to join him for breakfast, a sumptuous affair. Nothing much was said during the meal, but Isidore remembered the generosity of the god king. Isidore recounted one of the fables told in North Korea, how Kim was being driven through the countryside when he passed a woman whose tractor had broken down. Kim ordered his chauffeur to stop and then tow the broken tractor to the nearest town. The common people believe this story. My commentary, it's not impossible that this story is true. What was the difference between Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il? As far as foreign relations were concerned, Kim Il-sung was an excellent player. He juggled between China and Russia. Kim Jong-il had nothing of his father's ability to play foreign interests against each other. That is why Kim Jong-il only ever visited China and Russia, no other countries. Kim Il-sung tried to save and maintain the communist system, using political means on an international scale. Kim Jong-il did not use politics, but did his best to provide security for the country by force. The consequence was long-range rockets and 3 nuclear tests. Isidore did 4 spells in the Hermit Kingdom, from 1954 to 1960, from 1962 to 1965, from 1968 to 1973, and the last tour from 1979 to 1983. He became aware of a great change in the mood in North Korea when he returned in 1968. Before that date, foreigners from fellow communist countries like him had been free to travel around the whole country. Afterwards, Isidore and his fellow diplomats were locked inside Pyongyang and had to apply for official permission to move around the country, permission that was granted extremely rarely. The diplomatic lockdown reflected a deeper paranoia. The two great moments of Isidore's career under Ceausescu were the two presidential visits to Pyongyang in 1971 and 1978. In the great scheme of things, relations between two minor communist powers on either side of the world were not so very important, but the payoff for both Ceausescu and Kim Il-sung was that they could display their independence to Moscow and Beijing. However, many Romanians mark the 1971 trip to Pyongyang as the knife slash in time when Ceausescu lost his reason and sent his country galloping off in the wrong direction towards a national Stalinism. Sergiu Celac was Ceausescu's English translator until he got the sack in 1978. I met him in 1990. Celac noticed the dramatic change in Ceausescu on his return from North Korea. Up to 1971, by Marxist standards, he was able to generate new ideas within the limits of the system. After his visit to North Korea in 1971, something of crucial importance must have happened to his mind. What he saw in North Korea was an image of real socialism, that is, total regimentation. Of course, everything in Romania was fundamentally wrong from the beginning, but the practical approaches until 1971 were mitigated by a degree of realism and independent thinking, which had not yet become militant and destructive nationalism. I think that all his life he believed in what we considered to be the generous idea of socialism and communism. But in 1971, he apparently discovered the use of pyramidical organization inherent in one-party rule and the crucial importance of the top of the pyramid. He hated and despised Stalin, who had enjoyed just such a position, but Ceausescu hated Stalin because he saw him as a leader of an evil empire. The evil was its imperial character, not its ideology. Hence, Ceausescu was blind to his own messianic bent. So 1971 was the moment of rupture for him, and the date of the misfortunes he brought with him. If so, then Ceausescu's Romania was the only successful export of Kimist ideology. How much was Isidore aware of the dark side of the DPRK? He took a deep breath and paused for a time. A diplomat since he was 19 years old, and someone who served a communist dictatorship of increasing repression for most of his career, and for 18 years lived and worked in the worst tyranny on earth, Isidore knows that words can be heavy as lead. He looked down at the white tablecloth in front of him. If someone disappeared, you couldn't find them. He told me the tragedy of Georgeta Mircioiu, a Romanian woman who married a North Korean. She fell pregnant but went home to have the baby sometime in the early 1960s. She returned to North Korea for a time, but her baby fell sick and she went home once more. She was never allowed back to North Korea. They said her husband had left for the mountains, the code phrase for the gulag. The time frame is roughly the same as the 1967 purge that did for Ali Lameda and Jacques Sédillot, when any suspect foreigner or North Korean connected to a foreigner entered the shadows. To begin with, Georgetta was able to send and receive letters from her man. Then the letters stopped. For many years, maybe 15, maybe 20, said Isidore, she never gave up. She insisted that he was alive. She pressed the red cross. Nothing. Suddenly she received a hint that he was alive after all that time. Her hope was relit. Then, said Isidore with immense melancholy, she got a death certificate. Tell me about the tragedy of Doina Bumba, a beautiful Romanian artist who vanished off the face of the earth in 1978. See Chapter 17, The American Who Went to North Korea and Stayed. How long does Isidore think the regime will last? 30, 40, 50 years. I said my goodbyes to Isidore and Emilia and returned to the city centre. At the heart of Bucharest is the square in front of the old Central Committee building where Ceausescu made his last stumbling speech before his helicopter took him away. On Christmas Eve night 1989, the square was littered with tanks and armoured cars, residue of the battle that day. The old royal palace was a pockmarked ruin. Every building had its bullet acne, and some had been blasted into rubble. Here and there flames still licked at windows, roofs glowed a dull red. Despite the gunfire, people seethed around shouting, singing snatches of songs. Small bonfires illuminated their faces, some black with dirt, others the colour of whey, all exhausted. Shards of glass and spent bullet cases crackled underfoot. The songs died and the crowd flattened when an army gunner started blasting away pointlessly from a window inside the Central Committee building. There was no answering fire. The sniper he was furiously exterminating existed only in his head. A student came up to me. You must understand what a mindfuck Ceausescu has been for us. On Christmas morning I went looting in the Central Committee building itself. The windows had been shot to pieces. The floor was peppered with spent bullets, broken glass, fallen masonry. In one room was a stack of photograph albums, including one picture of a man in a Mao suit and Ceausescu. I ripped it out of the album and stuffed it in my coat. The man in the Mao suit, I now realize, was Kim Il-sung. After the shooting of the Ceausescus, the palace bodyguard in Pyongyang was increased from 4,000 men to 70,000. Chapter 13. The Washing of Brains. It was a bright cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13, is the opening sentence of the novel that prefigured the horrors of North Korea, George Orwell's 1984. But even the old Etonian seer would have been surprised, I expect, by the weird hollowness of the life of the mind, North Korean style. The Pyongyang University of Foreign Languages is no ordinary college. As always, we had a local guide who showed us that the Foreign Language Institute had been created under the wise guidance of Kim, blah, blah, blah. The KITC video has a jaunty middle-of-the-road jazz number playing as our party wanders around the university. The video shows a great slab on a wall where Kim Jong-il's giant ideogram hangs, dated 2009-12-17, showing that only 12 years after Juche time was established, it had been abandoned by the regime propaganda functionaries. They show us pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, empty corridors, emptier classrooms, a huge room where students might sit at the desks, listening to tapes whirring away of The Cat in the Hat, or whatever, entirely vacant. Something is missing. This is a university with no students. Where are the students? They are at a meeting, said Miss Kim. All of them? Yes, she said. This may well have been entirely true. It's apparently quite common for the regime to demand 100% presence of all students at a rally or even the rehearsal of a rally, and nothing takes precedence over obeisance to the state. Sorry, I've got an essay to write is not a functioning excuse in the DPRK. They showed us an intranet computer terminal which was linked to a library catalogue of sorts. On the KITC video, you can clearly hear me ask for a book by George Orwell, Animal Farm. To my intense disappointment, they had Orwell's great satire on Stalinism. Or, correction, the book showed up on the electronic menu. I never saw a hard copy of it. The computer may have been lying. But it's entirely possible that they do have Animal Farm in a North Korean university, but only because its true nature, to my mind the greatest satire ever written, has somehow escaped the clawed ears of the regime's censors. If so, raise a glass to Orwell's memory. In fact, do that anyway. The tour of empty spaces continued. In the corner of one room was a stack of simple learn-to-read magazines, heavily thumbed. Knowing North Korea, one wondered whether any of the fancy computer terminals and voice booths actually worked, or whether the foreign language students had to learn most of their English the old-fashioned way. As there were no students around, we could hardly ask them. One reason for the absence of students may have been because the Pyongyang University of Foreign Languages is a spy school. Its most famous alumnus is, according to U.S. congressional testimony, Kim Hyun-hee. Her claim to fame, and that of her school come university, is mass murder. The victims were 115 innocent people, mostly South Koreans, the passengers and crew of Korean Air Flight 858, which blew up mid-air on the 29th of November 1987. Kim and her fellow agent had planted the bomb, then got off at its first stopover at Abu Dhabi. The two agents were tracked down to Bahrain. Kim's partner dutifully killed himself by smoking a cyanide-laced cigarette, but Kim failed to puff hard enough on her suicide smoke. She was arrested and detained. In her memoir, The Tears of My Soul, she records what happened next. I was thrown onto a bed and handcuffed to the frame. A moment later, a middle-aged Caucasian couple entered the room. Both had blonde hair and blue eyes, and they looked at me curiously, but without malice. They were a British couple, Ian Henderson, the chief of police in Bahrain, and his wife, Maria. Kim recalls Maria telling her, "It's going to be all right, dear. Don't worry about a thing." And so Kim Hyun-hee's de-brainwashing commenced. The story is as grim as anyone could possibly imagine. A beautiful, gifted young woman, fluent in Japanese, good at English, trained to commit mass murder by the North Korean state. Hand-picked because of her talent at the Foreign Languages University, she was sent to a secret terrorist training base in the mountains and was then shipped halfway around the world to blow up her fellow Koreans. Kim Jong-il's logic was that such an outrage would frighten foreigners from coming to the 1988 Seoul Olympics. Far from it. Such was the world's disgust at the bomb that all talk of boycotting the Games by the communist world, in 1988 at the very fag end of its existence, stopped. Kim Hyun-hee was sentenced to death, but subsequently pardoned and served a relatively short time behind bars. She emerged from prison a chastened woman, and her book is a convincing account of someone who was effectively a victim of mental enslavement, a killing machine with no real idea of what she was doing to her fellow human beings when she planted the bomb. At a press conference in 1990, she expressed deep remorse. "Being a culprit, I do have a sense of agony with which I must fight. In that sense, I must still be a prisoner or a captive of a sense of guilt." She now lives in a safe house somewhere in South Korea, constantly guarded for fear of revenge from her victims' families, or perhaps more likely, from the North Korean regime, which has reportedly branded her a traitor. In the 21st century, the spy school slash University of Foreign Languages, has been keeping up the good work, with some of its students selling North Korean arms and nuclear materials on the international black market, according to an anonymous defector in 2010. Chosun Ilbo, the South Korean newspaper, reported that international sanctions against North Korea had made it difficult to export weapons in the ordinary way. The defector, who was under police protection and did not want his identity to be revealed, fearing reprisal attacks against family members still in the North, said that the black operation is run by traders from the Surveillance Division of the People's Armed Forces, one of the DPRK's myriad spy agencies, fluent in English and Chinese after studying at Pyongyang University of Foreign Languages. The scam works like this. North Korea sends containers across the Yalu River to China, one-third or half filled with weapons, missile components or technical equipment for higher-grade nuclear enrichment. The client, more often than not, is the research center of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. As you may imagine, this trade is very black indeed. The traders use their language skills in English and Chinese to broker deals with bent shipping agents in ports outside North Korea, presumably in China. The shipping agents, or forwarders, fill up the rest of the container with innocent machine parts or whatever, own the paperwork, and all trace of the true origin of the black goods has vanished. The defector explained that these laundered containers are re-laundered in Hong Kong, Singapore, or other ports. The containers are mixed with other cargo in those transit points. They are searched, but not thoroughly, the defector added. Even if customs or other officials roll their sleeves up and search for weapons, how can they possibly find the arms among the mountains of other containers headed to other countries? None of this was mentioned on our guided tour. Off we went across town to the Grand People's Study House, a giant pagoda affair right next to Kim Il-sung Square. In our world, you might call the study house the National Library, but a clue to the real theme of the place was soon evident. An enormous marble statue of Kim Il-sung in a Mao suit, sitting down in an armchair, hewn out of rock, a newspaper in his hand. Behind him are mountain peaks, pink-tipped at dawn, with a sugar coating of snow. After a while, you learn to date the propaganda from the clothes the Kims wear. Kim Il-sung sports Soviet commissar chic in the 1940s and early 1950s, shifting to Mao suits in the 1960s as the rupture with the de-Stalinizing Soviet Union was at its height. Mao suits may have become a tad unfashionable during the Cultural Revolution when the Red Guards were taunting Kim Il-sung as a fat revisionist, but were back in fashion for most of the 1970s. However, the end of Maoism and China's slide, or ascent, to free market economics means that by the start of the 1980s, Kim Il-sung throws away his Mao clobber and starts wearing a proper suit. When Kim Jong-il pops up in the propaganda statuary a few years later, he's down and dirty in the Mao suit, while his father looks more the conventional statesman in the classic CEO business suit. So I would place this statue of Kim Il-sung in Maoist garb no later than the 1980s and perhaps a decade earlier. They told us that the Grand People's Study House was home to 30 million books. There were stacks of books around, but nothing approaching a fraction of that number. Down a corridor, Kim's major and minor smiled down from the wall underneath a flickering fluorescent light. The walkway opened up into a chasm, lit by a dim-watted chandelier, but the temperature was freezing. I wore my coat throughout. We were taken to a strange place, like the area in an Argos store, where you sit and wait and wait and wait for the goods you've ordered. You file a request on an intranet computer. I asked for Solzhenitsyn. Nope. Did they by any chance have a copy of George Orwell's 1984? no joy. Instead, a miniature metal sleigh shot out from a mouse hole kind of orifice in a wall, bearing three books. One couldn't help wondering whether there really were 30 million books in there, or just one man sitting behind a wall with three books who gave the sleigh a push every time Western visitors popped into the grand study house. The three books that whizzed down the ramp were The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, something so boring I can't recall, and Discovering Food and Nutrition, which is funny because North Korea's standout event in the last 20 years, apart from three nuclear tests, is famine. They showed us a reading room full of ordinary North Koreans toiling over books. Were they for real or just for show? No one looked up as our chattering party of 13 foreign weirdos, half of us filming everything that moved, and Alex continually filming me, wandered in and made our on-the-spot inspection. And that is extremely peculiar. While investigating Scientology in 2007, our Panorama crew were given a tour of the church complex on L. Ron Hubbard Way in Los Angeles. I darted through the front door a split second in front of our minders, Tom Cruise lookalike Tommy Davis and Mike Rinder, who has since got out. What I saw was a whole room full of people poised in stop motion. Suddenly there was an unseen signal, and everybody started to walk purposefully crossways, just as they do in the church's surreally unreal promotional videos. In another room they showed us a grown man playing with plasticine. Mr. Hubbard worked out, said Tommy, that playing with clay figures helps Scientologists. The man lumped his figures into a ball and then rolled out his clay. In one long room there were dozens of people, bent over their studies or playing with clay, none of whom paid any attention whatsoever to the two agents, the reporter, the four separate people behind cameras, and the sound person with a very long boom. And that is weird. It is a simple constant of working for TV everywhere on the planet that people come up to you and say, "What are you filming?" And "What's it for?" And "When does it go out?" And "Hello, Mum." When people not only don't do that, but do the opposite and entirely ignore the cameras, one can reasonably deduce that they have been commanded to behave in that peculiar way beforehand. It was like wandering around inside the set of The Truman Show. The reading room of the Grand People's Study House in Pyongyang felt every bit as true to life as the Church of Scientology on L. Ron Hubbard Way, and that is not a compliment in this or any other galaxy. In January 2013, Sophie Schmidt went with her father, Google founder Eric Schmidt, and former New Mexico governor and UN ambassador Bill Richardson to Pyongyang. Sophie wrote, "Our trip was a mixture of highly staged encounters, tightly orchestrated viewings, and what seemed like genuine human moments. We had zero interactions with non-state-approved North Koreans, and were never far from our two minders. Ordinary North Koreans live in a near-total information bubble without any true frame of reference. The best description we could come up with is that it's like The Truman Show on a national scale. At the Kim Il-sung University e-library, there was one problem. No one was actually doing anything. A few scrolled or clicked, but the rest just stared. More disturbing, when our group walked in, a noisy bunch with media in tow, not one of them looked up from their desks. Not a head turn, no eye contact, no reaction to stimuli. They might as well have been figurines." Sophie and I may both be entirely wrong, and the people reading at the Grand Study House and Kim Il-sung University were not faking it. But after a few days in North Korea, you become so used to questioning the evidence of your own eyes that what you see feels fake. One day, after a particularly arduous stretch of bumpity-bump on the long empty motorway, we had an impromptu toilet stop. We tumbled out of the bus, desperate for a couple of minutes of terra firma. With nothing to see for miles, our minders didn't follow us, for once. After a few moments of fresh air, we were summoned back onto the bus. As I walked past Mr. Hyun, I could see he was hunched over, engrossed like a little boy, reading something. I peered over and was surprised to see it was a comic book. But this was not Superman, Batman, or Incredible Hulk. It was cartoon images of North Korean soldiers bayoneting, blowing up, or otherwise killing the American bastards. I realized then that Mr. Hyun was more of a believer than I had thought. In his own free time, he was choosing to read the regime's cartoon propaganda, and by the looks of things, thoroughly enjoying it. Later that same day, as we zipped past endless fields, I saw a woman on a chair reading a book. Nothing remarkable about it, except that the image stood out. Everywhere in the West, people read books, magazines, Kindles, newspapers. Yet over there, I only saw one person reading a book. But then, what are you going to read? World literature? Books on economics or philosophy? Not likely. Marxism-Leninism back in 1945, Juche-ism from the late 1950s, Kim Il-sung-ism from the 1980s, and now a hideous mutation of all three have squatted like a great toad on the North Korean mind. Dictatorships survive by enforcing ignorance, by keeping people undereducated. Gaddafi did this by making it virtually impossible for ordinary Libyans to learn English. But it strikes me that this process has been taken to a far deeper level in the DPRK. Are North Koreans brainwashed? And if they are, how deep does the brainwashing go? Mark Fitzpatrick is a witty American who has spent far too much of his life, first in the State Department and now at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, thinking about stopping nuclear Armageddon, triggered by the men from Pyongyang. His day job has scarred him. He does have a touch of the Dr. Strangelove about him. He told me, "It certainly would appear that the North Koreans are brainwashed. When you talk to North Koreans, you can have a normal conversation and think I'm really dealing with a human being, and then all of a sudden they go into this robotic recitation of North Korean policy, and you want to shake them and say, 'Come on, get real.'" The Korean Civil War made the term brainwashing fashionable. Thought reform has a long history, perhaps starting with the Spanish Inquisition. Perhaps before, refined and darkened by Stalin's secret police, the horror of mental enslavement brilliantly told in Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon. But brainwashing per se was introduced to a wider public by Richard Condon in his 1959 novel The Manchurian Candidate, about a returning American ex-prisoner of war who seeks high office in the United States but is, in fact, controlled by the communists, a story retold for Israeli TV viewers as Hatufim, which was itself picked up by US TV and retold as Homeland. The motor of the plot of all three is, can we trust a warrior who has been held in captivity by the enemy, or does he still belong to them? On brainwashing, the odd circularity of life breaks in. The world's great expert on the subject is a man called Professor Robert J. Lifton, author of Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, a study of brainwashing in China. I was introduced to Lifton's work by Bruce Hines while I was investigating Scientology. Hines was at one time an auditor, Scientology's word for confessor, who used to minister to Nicole Kidman, Kirstie Alley, and Tom Cruise, but he saw the light and got out. Lifton, an American military psychiatrist, spent the 1950s interviewing Allied ex-prisoners who had been captured during the Korean War and held in North Korea, and then Chinese and European victims of Chairman Mao's totalitarian state. He explains that the term brainwashing was first used by the American journalist Edward Hunter as a translation of the colloquialism "Xi Nao," literally "wash brain," which he quoted from Chinese informants who described its use after the communist takeover. Later, Lifton set out three defining characteristics of a cult. First, all cults have a charismatic leader who himself or herself increasingly becomes the object of worship and in many cases the dispenser of immortality. Spiritual ideas of a general kind give way to this deification of the leader. Secondly, in cults there is some kind of thought reform, popularly known as brainwashing. Thirdly, there is a pattern of manipulation and exploitation from above by leaders and ruling coteries, and idealism from below on the part of supplicants and recruits. To sum up Lifton's definers for a cult, 1, the leader is God, 2, brainwashing, 3, harm. On 2 out of 3, it's a no-brainer. North Korea is a cult. And brainwashing? Lifton sets out 8 tests for brainwashing. Test number 1 is milieu control or constriction, throttling of information. Lifton writes, "The most basic feature of the thought reform environment, the psychological current upon which all else depends, is the control of human communication. Through this milieu control, the totalist environment seeks to establish domain over not only the individual's communication with the outside, all that he sees and hears, reads and writes, experiences and expresses, but also in his penetration of his inner life, over what we may speak of as his communication with himself. It creates an atmosphere uncomfortably reminiscent of George Orwell's 1984. The most basic consequence of this information control, says Lifton, is the disruption of balance between self and outside world." Lifton's 7 other tests for brainwashing are mystical manipulation, a sense that the group ideology is beyond rational analysis, the demand for purity, that the in-group is pure and outsiders are impure, the cult of confession, that self-criticism is a public good, the sacred science, that the group's ideology is holy, loading the language, that words mean what the group's leaders want them to mean, doctrine over person, that the individual has no rights, and the dispensing of existence, that the masses must be willing to surrender life for the good of the whole. The professor sums up his 8 tests. The more clearly an environment expresses these 8 psychological themes, the greater its resemblance to ideological totalism, and the more it utilizes such totalist devices to change people, the greater its resemblance to thought reform or brainwashing. Quite a few people are highly skeptical that such a thing as brainwashing really exists. They cite legal precedents in the courts in the United States which rule out brainwashing as a defense. That may be sensible in a democracy, but it does not quite mean that the term has no use at all. Some prefer using the phrase thought reform, such as Jonathan Mirsky, one of the great experts on China, who called it the Auschwitz of the mind. I have yet to meet a North Korean defector who objected to the word brainwashing. I talked to 2 defectors who have ended up in London's Koreatown, New Malden, just off the A3, and asked them about their lives and whether they felt they had been brainwashed. Mary Lou still has a brother inside the North, hence her transparently un-Korean name. She's in her mid-30s, an attractive, feisty woman, lively, casually dressed, with a hint of bling. She was born in an area called Shinpo-shi, which is in the middle of the eastern coast. Their house was a small two-floor apartment in a block of flats. Outside Pyongyang, the flats are generally only about 5 stories high because there are no elevators, or if there are, they don't work. I asked Mary Lou whether she ever had any doubts about North Korea when she lived there, and she said she never had an inkling. She only realized how bad North Korea was when she left it, and then convinced her parents to escape as well. She told me a story about when she was in high school. There was this good-looking, strapping young boy who was also extremely smart, perfect, all round. All the girls were crazy about him, and when he went into the army, all the girls cried because they were sad to see him go. That was the last she saw of him, until many years later, when she noticed him at a train station among the homeless beggars. He had lost all his weight and was only a few days from death. He had lost so much weight in the army because of the lack of food, they had sent him home, but his family couldn't look after him either. So he eventually left home and ended up there. She bought him a suite with what little money she had, but he wouldn't take it because he felt embarrassed, especially because she had known him in his prime. She popped it in his mouth anyway, but he couldn't even control his saliva and was dribbling. He couldn't even move to stop her or wipe himself. She said the homeless man next to him was also bare bones, with a cut on his leg next to the knee that had become infected, and flies had laid their eggs in there. He had a little stick and was flicking the larvae that were coming out. Even seeing all this, Mary Lou said, she never thought there was anything wrong with North Korea and that this friend was just down on his luck. It's only looking back now that she realizes how awful it was. In 1997, at the height of the famine, her family moved by train to the sacred Mount Baktu, where Kim Jong-il was born, according to the official scripture, although that, of course, is a fiction. The train was packed, people sitting on top of each other. The journey from the east coast up to a town close to the Chinese border should have taken only 8 hours, but it took 10 days. It was very slow. There were so many power failures. I could see people falling asleep. I would try and slap them and discovered they were dead. How many died? I don't know. All the ordinary people died. Anyone who had energy left tried to escape to China. I saw dozens of people at stations and in market places starving. You became used to it. So many dead it wasn't even an event to see a corpse became unremarkable. Sometimes at the railway station, the railway workers would kick the people out. You could see them outside the apartment blocks. They would die from exposure, lying under plastic bags, in a corner away from the wind. You would see heaps of the dead. Mary Lou didn't escape because she had planned it or wanted to, but she was coerced into it by human traffickers. In 1998, she had gone to an area called Hyesanshi, which borders China, to sell stuff at the market. On the way, all her bags were stolen. She said theft was rife because everyone was struggling. She met a friend at Hyesanshi who had also had all her things stolen. They had nothing to sell, no money, and no way to get back home. After 3 days of being stuck in Hyesan, a North Korean guy came up to them and asked them to come with him to China for a day, promising that they would make more money in a day working at a Chinese farm than they would have made selling all their things. Seeing as they had no choice, they decided to give it a go. At the border, Mary Lou noticed that the land on the North Korean side of the river was barren, but on the Chinese side, full of trees. The smuggler knew where to go. They crossed the river in the dead of night, no moon shining, and the water up to her chest. How cold was it? I was so scared I didn't notice. She reckoned the smuggler might have paid off the guards. I asked what her first impressions of China were. In North Korea, at night, the only lights you see are the ones that shine on the statues of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. I looked back. It was very dark. Ahead, I saw neon lights, red, blue. I thought it was for a show, but there were lights in every house. Even tiny little villages had electricity. They got in a car and were driven deeper into China, further and further away from the border. They spent a night at a house, changed cars at various points, and everyone was really nice to them, saying they would get work and that they would take them back to North Korea when they were done, never realizing that as they were changing cars, they were being handed off or sold on to other buyers. Slowly it dawned on her that she wasn't just going to work on a farm. True enough, Mary Lou had been sold off to a farmer, a lonely ethnic Korean, the majority population in the borderlands. He'd bought her, lock, stock and barrel. When I went to the house of the man who bought me, I saw a whole stack of potatoes leaning against an outhouse. The spuds were shriveled. They had frozen, then thawed. They were half rotten, but in North Korea they were good food. I was startled and said, "Why are potatoes outside? I could make potato cakes." The man explained, "We don't eat that. That's for the pigs." My pride was hurt, not just the pig food, but also the fact that I had been duped into being sold off in the first place. He wasn't a bad man, this first husband, but I was 21, and you have dreams about the kind of man you want to marry. He was 27, and already he was looking down on me. One day my father-in-law said something rude about Kim Jong-il, and I cried. I wanted to go back to North Korea. This last sentence suggests that Mary Lou had been profoundly brainwashed, her mindset so narrow and forcibly blinkered that she preferred to return to North Korea than eat. But her ignorance of China and the distance she had already travelled made it impossible for her to go back. Slowly she adapted, and slowly it began to sink in that everything she had learnt in her entire life so far had been a cruel lie. Eventually Mary Lou had to leave China because she was ratted out and caught by the police. Although she was meant to be deported back to North Korea, her husband paid them off and got her released. Because she didn't have the right permits or paperwork, she and her husband decided to go to a bigger city where it would be harder for them to be discovered. They did, but even there was a danger of being caught. So her husband eventually decided to let her leave China and go to South Korea. She left in 2002, got to Seoul, found herself a new husband, like her, a North Korean refugee, and had two kids. She decided to come to Britain because she felt her children were being discriminated against in South Korea, a common complaint made by Koreans from the north. She now lives in New Malden, drives an Audi estate, and her children's English is getting better than their Korean. Mary Lou had last spoken to her brother, who is still inside the north, via a Chinese mobile phone the previous month. He travels up to a place very close to the Chinese border where the signal from the Chinese phone masts can reach inside North Korea, and they have a conversation. She also sends him money. "I wire the broker in China £3,000. My brother, Richard, gets £1,500 in Chinese yuan in the north." This is a small fortune in North Korea, and perversely makes the decision for him and his family to escape that much harder. The remaining £1,500 is split between the Chinese middleman and the North Korean broker, who smuggles the cash across and gets it to Richard and organizes the phone call. The deal takes place in a house close by the Chinese border, up a mountain where the phone signal is good. "Without the phone call," she said, "I can't be sure that Richard gets the money." The sad thing is that much of the time on the phone they spend arguing. "I always try and convince him to leave. It would only cost between £5,000 and £7,000 for him, his wife, and the baby to get out. But he feels betrayed by the rest of his family. He He has no idea what it is like outside. Our brother went into the army, placed him in a good position, but the rest of us have fled. So that is the cause of frustration and upset for him. Does Richard have any idea how poor North Korea is? He knows that North Korea is struggling because of America, but he is not really aware. We argue. I say, North Korea is poor. He says, don't talk like that. Do you think your brother is brainwashed? Yes. Anyone who is aware gets out. Is it like locked-in syndrome? Yes, because no one can say anything. Everyone has been trained by the government to spy on each other. If there were three of us talking, one would be spying. I always worry that the phone is being listened into. Sometimes the signal breaks or the phone crackles. We worry that they're spying on us. Would she ever go back? If I could go home without the government killing me and keep my money, then I would go back. I still dream about North Korea. I have nightmares, too. What kind of nightmares? It's always about the train journey during the famine. The people in the nightmare, their faces are formless, but they are starving, pinched, filthy. I notice they've fallen over, lying slumped on the floor. I tell a train guard. The bodies are covered with Hessian sacks and taken away, and then the power is cut. Sam, obviously not his real name, picks up the defector's narrative. He was born in the early 1970s in Kilju, near the East Sea, not far from the area where they carry out nuclear tests. His father was in the military, a worker peasant, a kind of North Korean version of Mao's Red Guards. His mother was a primary school teacher, one brother, one sister. They lived in a house on the edge of the city. There was an outside loo, no hot water, a pump in the basement. To understand North Korean society is difficult. You cannot compare it to here, he tells me. He's sporting a pinstriped suit, sipping on a can of Coke. For example, we had pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il in the house. Everyone had the same pictures. You had to take care of the pictures, to look after them. The regime propaganda bolsters this up, telling mind-warping stories in which loyal citizens prefer to lose all their possessions in a fire so long as they save the pictures of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. Of course I was brainwashed, says Sam. From when you are born until when you die, you are told what to think. A third of the lessons you get at school are about the legends of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. You never learn to question it, and no one would ever dare to mock it. The idea of school without mockery defeated me. He told